פסוק חף זיין, חבב. Actually, we're not quite finished with פסוק חבב. We're talking about the horses and how Shlomo HaMelech acquired vast amounts of horses, which is really kenegan the warning in the Torah. He thought, as the Gemara says, "Ani arba v'lo hashiv," I could take plenty of horses without falling into the trap of going to Mitzrayim. The question that we'd like to discuss this morning, and Mefarshim ask, is that Bishlama, when Shlomo married the many wives, thinking that they would not turn his heart aside, we can understand how Shlomo thought that, because when he married them, they weren't turning his heart aside. He did not realize what would happen when he got older. But in terms of Ashava Mitzrayim, I won't go back to Mitzrayim. Doesn't he see that he's going back to Mitzrayim? It says in the Pesukim, he bought the horses and he sent people to Mitzrayim to buy the horses. So how could he have fooled himself to think that he wouldn't when he's in the process of doing it? You know, I'm sending a mission to Egypt to buy horses, but don't worry, I won't go to Egypt. Excuse me, that's what you just did. So the Mefarshim basically point out, and this relates to a question that we raised last week, and that is that it's really permissible to go to Egypt. And for business purposes, and for temporary visits, it's permissible to go to Egypt. So what was wrong with what Shlomo did? And there were two explanations, the Mefarshim said. A number of Mefarshim learned that the problem is when you have somebody there permanently. To go in and out, buy your horses and leave, that's okay. But to have somebody stationed there permanently, that would be a violation of the Torah. So that's what happened. Shlomo thought that he'd be able to manage, he'd work it out, to buy all these horses without having anybody stay permanently. He would send a representative, he'd be there for a little while, come back, send somebody else. But in the end, the volume got so great that it ended up that people stayed there permanently. And Shlomo did not foresee that. So Shlomo thought that he'd be able to juggle and manage with his great chachma and managerial abilities, work the whole thing out without people staying there permanently, and ended up getting stuck. People stayed permanently. The second explanation that we said last week was the Maral. The Maral said that the prohibition is not to do haphazard business with Egypt, that's okay. But to become dependent upon them, that's the prohibition. So again, a similar thing. Shlomo thought that he could buy his horses without becoming dependent on Egypt. And in the end, he did become dependent on Egypt. So that is the way we would explain Shlomo HaMelech's error. All this is going with the Pashup Shad in the Gemara, Rashi's chat, that the mitzvah in the Torah is lo yarbe lo susim, you shouldn't have too many horses. And the reason for the mitzvah is that you shouldn't get stuck in Mitzrayim, either with permanent residence, or if the issue would be dependency on Mitzrayim. However, the Ramban learns it a little differently. It's a little bit unclear how he explains the lashon of the Gemara, but the way he learns the pasuk is that these are two separate things. One thing is not to have too many horses. I don't care where you get your horses, whether they're from Mitzrayim or anywhere else. And the second thing is you shouldn't go to Mitzrayim. The pasuk puts it together because they are linked to the extent that if you get a lot of horses and Mitzrayim was the best source for horses, you may end up going to Mitzrayim. But they really are two separate prohibitions. And the prohibitions of having too many horses would apply even if you got them from other places and never went to Mitzrayim. And by the way, there might actually be nafkaminas, because if you come to a point in history, let's say, where there are no horses in Mitzrayim, so maybe that according to the Pashup Shad, it would be permissible to have the horses. According to Ramban, it's not. So what's wrong with having all these horses if you're not going to Mitzrayim? Yes?
I was wondering if the prohibition is just buying all these horses, or is it like breeding also?
According to the Ramban, I don't know. It could be breeding also. I don't know. It says lo yarbe lo, you shouldn't have too many. If it's not connected to Mitzrayim, you might be right. Doesn't really matter how you get there. And actually, if you hear the Ramban's explanation, it sounds like that would be the case. The Ramban's explanation is, if there is no connection between the horses and Mitzrayim, what's wrong with having so many horses? He says, because horses, you have to understand what horses represent. Horses were tanks. That was your armor. They weren't armor, but they pulled the chariots. It was a military inyan to have horses to do farm work and to do transportation and so on. You don't need that many horses. Having large numbers of horses is for battle purposes. It's a military advantage. So what the Torah is telling them is, don't invest so much into having a military advantage. You need to have bitachon. Kal Yisrael does not work under normal rules. You have to have horses. It doesn't say you shouldn't have horses at all. Below yar, below susim. To think that we rise or fall on the quality of our military and the size of our military is a mistake. We rise and fall through the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the hand of God and through our bitachon. And in fact, I'm reminded of a... some people may remember the rescue of the Israeli hostages in Entebbe a number of years ago. It was a very successful military operation. If you read the details of what happened, it could just as easily have gone wrong. And in fact, there were other very, you know, planned out military operations that did go wrong. If you remember, not much longer, there was an attempt to kill the head of Hamas in Damascus that got all messed up. So they could go right and they go wrong. When you go right, all of a sudden we have great military, tremendous planning, prowess, everything else. Yad Siyata Dishmaya. I remember a book that came out on the TV. There was a race. You know there had to be a book. There was more than one, obviously. So once this happened, there was a race to produce the first book. So there was an Israeli journalist who had a lot of connections with the military, and his book was the first one to come out. So naturally it sold very well. The I saw that book, and I read their introduction. And the introduction was a beautiful piece if you would only substitute the word God for Tzahal. It reads, the lesson of Entebbe is that we really can't rely on our friends, we can't rely on other countries. The only one that could guarantee security of our citizens is Tzahal. And you're going through the whole piece. I don't know if he wrote a book after the mission in Damascus. Now that you can't rely on any of your friends, and you also can't rely on Tzahal, now what? So there is a tendency that if you have a tremendous investment in your military, a very powerful military apparatus, that you begin to lose sight of the forest for the trees, and you begin to think that it's your susim, it's your armor, it's your that's going to save you. And unfortunately, we fall trapped to this all the time, and it is something that's not, again, there is a certain level of ishtadlus, of effort that you have to put in, and you need to have a military, but you should never think that that's what wins or loses the wars. And to me, in a certain way, it's almost amusing, it wouldn't be so serious, how you see this. Like when there's a success, all of a sudden the military is great. Then when there's a failure, a bunch of incompetence. And they weren't so great when they were successful, and they weren't so incompetent when they failed. So many things can go wrong in any operation. And if everything clicks into place, you look good. And if it doesn't, you look bad. But it wasn't you. It wasn't your success, and it wasn't your failure. And this is the typical downfall. So that, according to the Ramban, the Azhara of Lo Yabelo Susim has nothing to do with Egypt. Even if that were not a factor, that's a second issue. There could be a problem with Egypt too. But even if that were a factor or not a factor, there's a problem inherent in investing too much in your military that makes you think that it's the military that guarantees success, military that gives you victory, and that's not the case at all.
But the military, you still have to do the shtadlus of
right.
The military.
Right, I said that.
Yeah.
You still need to have a military. It has to, again, you know, we don't rely on miracles, but you need to understand with all your hishtadlus, it doesn't guarantee you anything.
Right.
And it's still and if you think you'll double the size of the army, then you'll be guaranteed, you still won't be guaranteed. So you have to do whatever is reasonable, and then you have to understand that it's not in your hands. It's in the...
But if you double the size of your army, then there should be an obvious chance of a higher chance of winning.
Not necessarily. At a certain point, it's diminishing returns, and not necessarily. You may be coming at a cost to your entire society, and not really true. You know, like who had a larger army, United States or Vietnam? United States army is much, much larger than Vietnam. Better technology, more resources, and one would be hard pressed to think that the United States is victorious in Vietnam. So I don't doubt that there are people who think so. There's still some people who think the world is flat. But there's more to it. Okay, so you'll get your historians explaining all the reasons why they didn't have the political will and the support. Whatever the reasons are, the fact of the matter is, you see, it didn't work. And
well, Israel has won the last year and a half.
Okay.
So instead of buying a $100 lotto ticket, just buy a $1 ticket, you have the same chance of winning, right?
That's right. Well, you know the story, there's a story mentioning the lottery that with Rabbi Aryeh Levin, who was known, there's a book written on him called Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, and Tzaddik in Our Time, right? And the Hebrew version was Ish Tzaddik Haya, that he was quite a tzaddik, and the story quite impressive. But one story about this bitachon, there was a couple that was having marital problems, and they came to him for counseling. And they walk in, the husband and the wife goes on a tirade, basically how the husband is a very low-paying job, and he spends half his paycheck on lottery tickets. And they don't have enough to eat, and they can't pay the rent, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's not saying a word the whole time. So Rabbi Levin asks the lady, could you please step outside for a minute? I want to talk to your husband privately. So she steps outside, and then he opens up and says, you can't tell me not to buy lottery tickets. He says, I have no training, I have no education, I'm stuck in a dead-end, low-paying job for my entire life. My only hope to get out of it is lottery tickets. It's winning the lottery. I have to buy the tickets. So Rabbi Levin said to him, tell me something. Do you believe in God? And he said, yes. Do you believe if God wants you to win the lottery, that you'll win the lottery? He said, yes. Do you believe if God does not want you to win the lottery, that you won't win the lottery? He said, yes. He says, then why do you have to buy 100 tickets? Buy one ticket. If God wants you to win, you'll win with one ticket. If he doesn't want you to win, you won't win with 100 tickets either. So you could buy a lottery ticket, buy one ticket each week. So he said, if you give me a bracha that I should win, then I'll buy one ticket. So Rabbi Levine said, okay, I give you a bracha that you should win. So he agreed. So from then on, he was buying one lottery ticket. About 6 or 7 months later, he won. So a number of people who were familiar with the story came over to Rav Aryeh Levin. It's not what you think. They came over to Rav Aryeh Levin and they said, why don't you buy a lottery ticket? If you could give a bracha and he wins, you should buy the ticket yourself. He said, oh no, I would never buy a lottery ticket, I'm afraid. So what's to be afraid? $1, whatever is, 1 lira, 1 shekel, I don't know what they were up to before the shekels. How much does a lottery ticket cost? What's there to be afraid of? Oh no, I'm afraid. So what do you mean you're afraid? You're afraid you're going to lose 1 shekel? He says, no, I'm afraid I'm going to win. I'm afraid. What would I do if I had all that money? Would I be able to handle it properly? Would I be able to live up to responsibility? Will I not fall into the temptation of arrogance, of who knows what? I'm better off the way I am. I know I can handle it. I've been doing a reasonably good job until now. Hopefully I could continue. Who knows what would happen to me if I won all that money? So he said, he doesn't buy a ticket, he's afraid he's going to win.
But if you win, that means Hashem thinks you can handle all that money.
All right, but that, you know, I don't have to necessarily put myself into that position. But if you want, you could try. You want to buy the one lottery ticket, it's okay, but not more.
I'll keep you updated.
Okay. But if I give a bracha, it has to be for 50% of the profits.
You can handle the money?
I'm not really that worried. All right. Pasuk of Zion. Vayitain ha-melech es ha-kesef Yerushalayim ka-banim. And the king gave the money or the silver in Yerushalayim like stones. Beis ha-razim and cedar wood. Nosan kishkamim. It's translated as sycamores, as shebish fele l'rob, which are like grow in great multitudes in the valley. Shkamim are very cheap wood, and arazim are the most expensive types of wood. So there was so much wealth in Yerushalayim that nobody bothered with sycamores, with shkamim. Everyone was getting the best cedar, and that was as common as normally the cheaper woods would be. We mentioned before that the earlier pasuk says, Ein kesef chashuv me'uma, the kesef was considered worthless, was nothing. And here, it says it was like stones. Stones is not quite worthless. It's a little something. So the Chazal say that there was a decline in the riches. Once Shlomo married the daughter of Paro and began on the road to the Chet, then the wealth declined somewhat. It was still fabulously wealthy, but it was a drop lower, and now we would say that silver is kavanah. What we do see from this pasuk, and we mentioned this before in reference to other inyanim, was that the money did not stay in the hands of Shlomo. It says vayitain b'Yerushalayim. It was distributed for different purposes, whatever it may be. We don't know exactly how it went about, but the money didn't stay in the hands of the king. The wealth spread throughout Yerushalayim. There's a very interesting Barbanel, and the Malbim really also says follows his Mahalik with slight variation. But a different explanation of how the wealth spread in Yerushalayim. It wasn't through direct government subsidies. I suppose you might make this into a political debate. You know, whether does the government distribute the money or is it private sector? But the Barbanel says, and Malbim with a little variation, that the reason why there was so much silver, so much wealth in Yerushalayim was not because Shlomo was giving out the money, it was because of the increased commerce and business that happened because of Shlomo. Since Shlomo was the king of Yerushalayim and everybody came from all over the world to see him, so there's tremendous traffic in Yerushalayim. There's a tremendous tourist industry. People came, so they had to, you know, pay for their hotels or whatever they had in those days. They bought things. It increases commerce. Or, and additionally, Shlomo had a very large staff, so there was a huge payroll, and that put money into the economy. And he had all these riders we mentioned before, the horses and the riders, that also generates income. So what ended up happening, because of the vastness of Shlomo's malchus, of his royal staff, and because of the tremendous traffic that it generated, that everyone in Yerushalayim became rich. So this is a interesting early lesson in economics, that how this type of, you know, that the increased economic activity because of the attraction of Shlomo, because of his staff and because of his payroll, actually spills over to the entire community. There is there are actually other explanations in Chazal to explain this pasuk of Kavanim. One of them is brought down in the name of Rabbi Yossi, a very interesting pshat. He learns the pasuk literally, Vayitein ha-melech es ha-kesef Yerushalayim ka-banim, that Shlomo put silver in the streets of Yerushalayim like stones. Just like if you had a stone, you would toss it into the street. Shlomo put silver into the street. What was he doing? Apparently he had these humongous bars of silver. According to one opinion, they were 8 amos long. According to another opinion, they were 10 amos long. So let's say something between 16 to 20 feet. We don't know how wide and thick they were. And these silver bars were placed in the street to demonstrate the wealth of Shlomo HaMelech. They were so big and so heavy that he wasn't worried that they would be stolen, because you couldn't pick them up. And in order to steal, you would have to have like a whole gang and who knows what, a few trucks and cranes, and it would be a whole operation. and therefore nobody would ever even try. So he had such huge pieces of silver, he was able to put it in the street like stones, with no fear of Geneva, because it was, they were basically impossible to steal. So this was the... this is what the pasuk refers to. That, of course, leads to the obvious question as to why in the world he was doing this. Right? We generally have a concept of hatznei aleches. A person is supposed to have a sense of privacy. If you're wealthy, you're not supposed to show off your wealth. Why was Shlomo showing off his wealth? And the answer is that there is a reason, when it comes to leadership, there is a certain need for people to know that you're wealthy. It's there is a psychology in human nature that people accept what a rich man says more readily than another person. For better or for worse, but apparently it's ingrained in human psychology. Yes.
The Kohen Gadol, the Dafka made him, you know, gave him all the money to be the richest amongst them. For,
right.
For that reason.
And a Navi, for example, there are 10 milas in a Navi. Navi akim bekibbutzim kamocha. So there are 10 milas in a Navi, it's brought down in the Rambam, and one of them is Osher. That a Navi has to be rich. Or at least it's a mila in the view, it's a little bit of a shaila in the Mefarshim, whether they're ma'akev, it could be that some of the Vim didn't have all of these 10 milas. But one of the milas of a Navi is to be rich. Why does a Navi have to be rich? And for the same reason, that a rich person's words tend to be accepted. You know, there is no particular correlation that a rich person is any smarter than a person who is not rich. And especially depends how they got their money. You know, a rich person could be rich because he inherited it. It doesn't matter. You know, it could be a very lucky thing. He got his wealth. He could win the lottery. No sign of intelligence. But if he has the money, people listen to him. There's a certain psychology that people listen to him, and apparently it's very pervasive and ingrained if that's going to be one of the milas of a Navi. And therefore, Shlomo HaMelech, who was the Chacham Mikol Adam, understood this, and he knew that if people, he wanted people to listen to him, he should be able to exercise his authority properly. It would be a good idea for them to know how rich he was. Okay, pasuk chav ches. Umotza hasusim asher li Shlomo, the source of the horses that Shlomo had. Mi Mitzrayim, were from Egypt. Umikveh. Now this is a very confusing word. We'll first interpret it as the Targum does. The Targum learns that Kvei is the name of a place. They were Mi Mitzrayim Umikvei. They came from Mitzrayim and from Kvei. The Socharei HaMelech, the merchants of the king, Yikru Mikvei B'Mechir, would buy the horses from Kvei at full price. In other words, the way the Targum Yonason is learning is that the Egyptian horses he got at a discount. But the Kaveh horses, he had to pay full price. Why do you suppose he got the Egyptian horses at a discount? His father-in-law. He was married to the Bas Paro, so the father-in-law gave his son-in-law a break. Right? So he got the horses from Mitzrayim at a discount, but the horses from Kaveh, he had to pay full price. Rabbi. Even the discount, we'll see in a moment, we're not so cheap. But we'll get to that in a second. Yes?
Yeah. The word Umikveh, you read it, Kveh is the name of the city.
Right.
Shouldn't there be a dogish in the coup?
I'm not sure, but one thing I will tell you.
Both issues are no.
Yeah, I'm not such an expert on dictic, you might be right. But if you look also at the trup in the pasuk, it doesn't support this chat. Because there's an esnachta, which is a pause on Mitzrayim, and that would indicate that Umikveh begins a new clause. If it is the interpreted as the Targum Yonason does, then the esnachta should have been under Mikveh, and Rashi notes this. So the pasuk should have been divided. Umotza asusim sheli shomim Mitzrayim Umikveh, and then Sofrei Melech Yikru Umikveh b'mechir. So that is a difficulty with this explanation in the pasuk. And maybe you're, I don't know the halachas of the Dagesh, I must admit my lack of expertise, but that might also be an issue. So Rashi learns that mikveh means gathering. When we say mikveh mayim, we call a mikveh, it's really a gathering of water. So he reads the pasuk as follows. The source of Shlomo's horses were Mitzrayim. That was the only source. Umikvei socharei hamelech yikvu mikvei b'mechir. There's the gathering of the merchants of the king would buy them from the gathering of the Egyptian merchants b'mechir at a price, not at full price, but at a discount price. As is implied in the next pasuk. So everyone agrees that Shlomo got his horses from Mitzrayim at a discount. The Targum Yonason learns there were two sources of horses, and Kveh is the other one. Rashi learns there was one source of horses, and Mikveh is a gathering, and it's repeated twice, which is the difficulty with Rashi's reading, to say two gatherings. There's the gathering that Shlomo sent a whole bunch of his horse merchants, and then Mitzrayim sent a whole bunch of their horse merchants, and they got together and worked out the price, and delivered the horses to Yisrael. There is a third approach. The Radak quotes this in the name of his father, and the Ralbag also says it, which is a kind of completely different reading, also has its difficulties, that he says mikveh, and again, I don't know the diktuk here, but says that the root of mikveh is kav. Kav is a line, or a string, and it says these were fancy threads, chut hashani, fancy threads that were produced in Mitzrayim, and Shlomo bought those as well. They bought the horses, umikveh, and they bought these strings, and they bought those strings at a high price because they were very valuable. And then the next puzzle goes back to the horses. So those are the three explanations. They're just in terms of the actual reading of the pasuk. Hayotze, according to all the explanations, was that at least a portion of, if not all, of Shlomo's horses did come from Mitzrayim and led ultimately to the violation of the pasuk Shlo Yashava Mitzrayim Elaman Harbasus. Moving on to Chavtes, he might actually finish the perek. Very rare event in our shir. Happens once in a while. So, Pasuk of Tes, Vatale, and they brought him up, meaning to Eretz Yisrael, Vatetze Merkava Mimitzrayim, and they brought chariots from Mitzrayim, B'sheish Meos Kesef, for 600 Kesef, Shkolim of Kesef, V'sus, and a horse, V'chamishim Umeya, and so too, for all the kings of the Chitim and the kings of Aram, they were taken out with his hands. With whose hands? So one parish is that Shlomo did it. Shlomo's servants delivered horses to Chitim and Aram. This is a real Jewish businessman. You'll note that Shlomo was getting the Egyptian horses at a discount. Either he didn't have to pay the taxes, according to one opinion, or he's given a discounted price. So he was able to resell the horses to Chitim and Aram at a profit. So in other words, not only did Shlomo export or import horses from Egypt for his own use, he imported additional horses, which he sold to Chitim and Aram, and made a profit on the side. I'm not sure how much the king of Mitzrayim and Paro appreciated this, but that's what he said. Others interpret that the chenechal mache chitim mache aram biyodim yotziu is that they also purchased the horses at this same price, despite the fact that they were actually closer to Mitzrayim. Now I don't know if that is the pshat. It's not referring to what we typically call aram. We typically refer to aram as Syria and Iraq, and that's further from Mitzrayim. So according to this explanation, Aram must be referring to something else. But they were closer to Mitzrayim, and therefore their costs should have been higher, and thus the cost was inclusive of transportation. So this is to demonstrate the discount that Shlomo had. Shlomo, although he was further away, got the same price, delivery included, as the countries that were closer, when they really the cost should have been more. But whatever it may be, all the opinions agree that he got all these horses from Mitzrayim, that he paid a discount price. Now, Afal Pi Kein, it was improper because he had too many of them, and that caused the various consequences. Okay, now beginning into Perek Yud Aleph. Perek Yud Aleph begins with a description of the Chet of Shlomo HaMelech. Let's take a look at the first pasuk. Well, many of these issues we discussed already a number of months ago when we were talking about Shlomo's marriage to Bas Paro. So I don't really want to rehash that to a great extent, but we'll touch upon it as well as a number of the new points or issues. Excuse me, that come up in these pasukim. Vamelach Shlomo and the King Shlomo, Ahav Nashim Nachrios, loved foreign women, Rabos, many of them, the Es Bas Paro and also Bas Paro. The reason why it says many foreign women and then singles out Bas Paro, Chazal said Bas Paro was equal to all of them. He was equal to all of them in terms of the love that Shlomo had for her, and she was equal to all of them in terms of the damage that she did. And she was the most dangerous of all of them, and she did as much damage as all the other wives put together. And maybe it's because Shlomo loved her more than as much as all the others put together. Included amongst the group was Moavios, Ammonios, Aramios, Sidonios, and Chitios. This raises other issues because Sidonios and Chitios were from the Sheva Zion Umim, the seven nations of Canaan, where there was clearly a prohibition of marrying them. Also, Bas Paro was a mitzris, where there's a prohibition of marrying. So this raises a number of issues. In essence, the Mefarshim point out that there were three failures, if you will, in Shlomo's behavior. Number one was Ahav Nashim Nachrios. His love was excessive, and it clouded his judgment. As Chazal say, Ahava Mekalkel says Ashura, love is a nice thing, but it has to be within bounds. There's no such thing as an emotion dominating you and overriding your seichel. If you do, not that there's no such thing, but there should be no such thing. And if it happens, you're in trouble, regardless of what that emotion is. Even if it is inherently not necessarily a bad emotion, but a good one, but when it dominates, then you make mistakes and you do things wrong. So Ahava Mekalkel says Ashura. It's, by the way, very important to keep that in mind, particularly in situations where a person is dealing with his own close family, or with parents, or with spouses. And, you know, sometimes we have a tendency to be overprotective or over-defensive, because Ahava Mekalkel says Ashura, and we can't be objective. And at least we should be aware of that and not be so sure that our position is always right. On the other hand, sometimes a parent has greater insights, let's say, in the child than let's say, his teachers or others that might be dealing with them. But with that comes the balancing factor that we may have greater negios, greater biases, Ahava Mekalkel Ashura. The second thing was that they were Nachrios. They were foreigners. We'll get into more detail about this. Nachri is almost always used for non-Jews. A non-Jew who converts is not called a Nachri. And the majority opinion was that all these women converted. So then the question is, why does the pasuk refer to them as Nachrios? We'll get to that. I don't know if we'll make it this week, but we'll get to that a little bit later.
Maybe because of their actions.
Maybe, but we'll talk about that. And a third factor was that it's Rabos, that he had too many of them, which is what we discussed before, Lo Yir B'Lo Nashim. And even if they would not have been Nachrios, and they would not have been, and he would not have had the excessive Abba, the mere fact that there were too many of them would have been a problem. So there were three problems that Shlomo opened himself up to. The nature of these wives, that they were foreigners, the fact that they were so many, and the fact that he went over the line in terms of his love for them. Now, we mentioned in the past, and just briefly recap, that we find actually in different sources in Chazal three opinions to Shlomo. The pasuk later is going to describe Shlomo's chet and would appear at its surface that it related to Avodah Zarah. So what actually happened? So there are three opinions. One is that he did in fact sin, and according to that opinion, there was a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin whether he lost his chelik in Olam Haba, and the Sanhedrin wanted to include him on the list of those kings who have no chelik in Olam Haba. And there's a whole argument, and finally a Baskol came down and said that he does have a chelik in Olam Haba because he was a Zariz in building the Beis HaMikdash, and they still weren't ready to accept it. They said, Lo b'shamayim hi, that Torah is not in the heavens. There's a concept that once the Torah was given to Kal Yisrael, then we have the right to interpret and understand the Torah, and even if it differs, so to speak, with what God originally said, Torah follows what goes on in earth. To which HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered, that's only things that are nogeya on earth. If you're talking about halachas on this world, so then the halacha prevails regardless of whether or not that's what God said. But when we're talking about Olam Haba, that's God's domain. If I say, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if I say he's in Olam Haba, then he's in Olam Haba. You can't stop me. It's interesting to note that apparently they thought they could. Because the power of Sanhedrin is so great, if they pass and he's not in Olam Haba, then he's not. They thought that he would not be in Olam Haba. And even if God says differently. But apparently that's not the case. But those things which are nogeya on this earth, that is the case. In fact, the Gemara relates a very interesting story. I believe it was Rabbah, but I wouldn't be held to that. That there was a machlokas how to tie the knot in the tzitzis. And Rabbah discovered that there was an Arab merchant who knew where the Mesei Midbar, the people who died in the desert, could be found. Their bodies could be found. So you know when you bury a person, they're buried in a talus. So he said he's going to go look and see how they tied the tzitzis. So he hired this guy, take him to the grave, found the grave, found the tzitzis, looked how they tied it, and he came back. And when he came back, he couldn't remember what he saw. So he went back a second time. And this time he was very careful, you know, to make sure he had it down pat, comes back, still couldn't remember what he saw. So then he went a third time, and what he did was he cut off the corner of one of the talasim and put it in his pocket. They get on the camel to drive back. Camel won't move. And they banging at the kitty, whatever, he will not budge. So the Arab said to Rabbi, did you take anything out of the graves? So he said, yes. He says, that's why we can't move. Put it back or we'll be here forever. Nothing could be taken from the grave. So he put the tzitzis back. They were able to go home. He couldn't remember what he saw, and he realized that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not want him to know what the... You're supposed to figure out yourself. It doesn't matter what kind of knot they had on their tzitzis. If Bez and Paskin's a different knot, then it'll be a different knot, and that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. Have Yasser b'ni kachu omer, Yonasan b'ni kachu omer. But that's only on things that relate to how we conduct ourselves in this world. But things that only relate to Shemayim, it doesn't work like that. That's one opinion. The second opinion is a medrash that says that he did sin, but he did tshuva. Based on Pesukim later, indicated that he did tshuva. The third opinion, which is also in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, a different Gemara in Sanhedrin, Sanhedrin and other places, says that he never really sinned. And they're medayik from a Pesuk later, where he's described as not reaching the level of David. He says, not reaching the level of David is not the same thing as sinning. And he says he didn't sin, and we were going to, for the most part, follow that interpretation. That seems to be the main opinion. And in fact, if you notice in the Nusach, when we make a Mishaberach for a Cholim, and we're invoking the Zeschusim of great people, so who do we mention? Right? We mention he's in the same company as Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, David, and Shlomo. So clearly the prevailing opinion, one that's been accepted for the Doros, is this opinion of the Gemara that says that he never really sinned. There were certain criticisms of him. There were certain failures in terms of the expectations of Shlomo HaMelech, who HaKadosh Baruch Hu had hoped would reach the level of David, and he didn't quite make it. But to describe these things as actual sins would be a mistake.
When David sinned, the Navi came right to him and told him, and David said, Katasi. Where was the Navi for Shlomo?
There will be a Navi for Shlomo. We'll get to it.
Got it.
It's coming up in this parak.
Got it.
Okay. Now, all the opinions agree that Shlomo's motivations were l'shem shemayim. And what Shlomo did was absolutely l'shem shemayim, to accomplish great things for Kal Yisrael and for Torah, for Kiddush Shem Shemayim. The only difference in the opinion is things went wrong, and what happened when they went wrong. But his initial motivation was clearly l'shem shemayim. That was actually almost spelt out beferish in the pasuk in the parsha Ba'asheva, where it talks about his l'shem. At that point, it said he was like David. This was even when he was marrying Ba'asheva. It compared him to David. It's only now, later, when he got old, that he says he was not like David. So very clearly, the psukim indicate that what he did was done l'shem shemayim. There was no chait, and even the actual marriage of all these wives was only a chait in the sense of violating lo yirbe lo nashim, but not because they were nafrios or ma'avios, and not because of the ava and so on. These were failures or weaknesses in his approach, which led to certain problems, which may or may not have been actual sins. But clearly the initial effort was completely l'shem shemayim. And back in that parak that discussed Ba'asheva, he was compared to David, because even after, at the time he married Ba'asheva, he was still in the same league. I'm sorry, Bas Paro. He was still in the same league as David HaMelech when he married Bas Paro. So, why did he do it? So, I've identified three reasons in the Mefarshim, two of which I could explain and one of which I can't. One reason was to strengthen the political position of Kal Yisrael. This was a common, even many, many years later, where by marrying princesses from different countries, it exerts a certain influence and control over those countries, political alliances. So it makes the position of Kal Yisrael more secure and more safe. And he was doing this, therefore, to benefit Kal Yisrael politically. Secondly, he wanted to spread Emunah Bashem amongst the nations. And by getting an in, so to speak, into all these households, he had the opportunity to bring them the word of God, and they should all believe in Hashem. The third one is mystical, Kabbalistic, that he wanted to be matzil the nitzotzes HaKedusha. Now, as I understand it, which is admittedly rather limited, that there's a certain Kabbalistic concept that when chait occurred, certainly the chait of Adam Rishon, and really every chait, really, the world is created with Kedusha. The word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates the world. So it's permeated with Kedusha and sanctity. But Chait covers it up. The Kabbalistic terminology is klipos, shells, like peels, covering up the Kedusha. So when Chait was committed, all this Kedusha scattered like so many sparks and got covered up by these klipos. So Kedusha resides in everywhere, in the Umas HaOlam as well. For the ultimate Geula to come, this Kedusha has to be retrieved. And this was part of Shlomo's plan. Exactly how it works, I don't know, to retrieve the Kedusha from the Umas HaOlam. According to the Chidah, his mistake was bringing them into the palace. It's a good approach to try to be matzil the nitzotzes on Kedusha, but don't make them princesses of Klal Yisrael. That's too much. You go to them. Don't bring them to you. So he, whatever it was, that's the Kabbalistic approach. But Yehemiah, and it could be all of them were true. Right? One does not preclude the other. But Shlomo's intentions were l'shem shemayim, to help Klal Yisrael politically, to bring the word of Hashem, the belief in Hashem, to all the Umas HaOlam, and some kind of mystical concept which to be matzil the nitzotzes HaKedusha. So clearly, Shlomo HaMelech's intentions were l'shem shemayim. However, afal pikein, he did not end up reaching what HaKadosh Baruch Hu expected him to reach.
There's a few quick announcements. The regular show upstairs.